From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast. It's episode 23 for Thursday, the 28th of April, 2011. On the show this week is this.
Wow! Absolutely perfect. That couldn't have been any better. That was fantastic. Look at how close he hit to the center of the bullseye.
Bombs. That's what we're talking about this week, specifically the bouncing kind used by the Dambusters in the Second World War, which are being recreated by a documentary team. We'll be talking to the University of Cambridge engineer behind the project to find out how they've done it. That's all coming up after we peruse the week in Wired News. Hi, I'm Nate Langston, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me... Oh, I've not put a place where we're being joined today, so we're just going to go with the default, which is where we are, is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Good afternoon. No, good morning. Well, it depends on when you're listening to this, I suppose.
I'm listening to it now. And also here with us now listening is news editor Olivia underscore Solan.
Hello.
How are we all?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent.
I just want to do a quick straw poll. How few of us care at all about this royal wedding nonsense rubbish?
I don't know what the answer to that is, but I don't care.
I care a little bit. It'll be fun to watch. It's not going to change my life or anything, but I'm going to tune in, watch it.
Well, we're recording this on a Thursday because we get a day off because some people are getting married. So once again,
can't complain about that.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. It means we have to do a podcast on a Thursday instead of a Friday, which is just so much better to do a podcast on. Never mind. Anyway. Wait, don't we normally record on a Thursday? What day is it?
Yeah, we do. We do normally record on a Thursday.
Okay, well, anyway, let's get on with the news. First is that the PlayStation Network has had something of an epic fail over the last week. Sony has confirmed that about a week ago, hackers broke into its system and potentially took credit card details, personal identifiable information.
They've said that they definitely took personal information and they're not sure about the credit card details, but they're advising people to be careful nonetheless.
Yeah, and the knock-on effect of this is that as a security measure, Sony switched off the entire PlayStation Network and its Curiosity music streaming service. So no one with a PlayStation 3 globally has been able to use any online gaming for a week.
So how many people does that affect then?
Well, they've got 77 million registered members, you know, almost 80 million people globally on the service. None of them can use online Sony PlayStation gaming and have potentially had other things taken.
Yeah, so what are the details that they might have taken or might not have taken?
Well, it depends exactly what they had access to, but obviously usernames and passwords and their online ID for the PlayStation Network, also credit card numbers, credit card expiry dates, so really, and email addresses and your personal mailing address.
Probably postal addresses, yeah,
exactly.
Date of birth, that kind of thing.
So you're potentially looking at quite a huge amount of personal information, you know, where you live, how to get in touch with you, and your financial details. You know, none of that has been confirmed to be definitely taken, but certainly they've had access to, you know, the inside of the network, which... Whew.
So do they have any idea who's actually done this?
No, basically, no. At least no one's come forward to take responsibility, and Sony hasn't released any statement about who it is. I mean, there was a little bit of chatter about the anonymous group, but this just doesn't smell like anything they do.
They've denied it. And I mean, Of course, with the very nature of anonymous, it's very difficult for them to sort of say, no, none of us did this, because it's this enormously loose group of people.
Yeah,
but it doesn't seem like their kind of handiwork. It's not playful. It seems more malicious.
Yeah, anonymous is, for anyone who doesn't know, a bit of a vigilante group that's gone after people who, you know, have, say, not supported WikiLeaks. MasterCard, I think, was attacked. Visa.
Also targeted people like the Church of Scientology and...
And basically just taking their websites offline or stopping their service working by what's called a DDoS, a distributed denial of service attack, where you basically just hammer their systems until they can't work anymore. But this just isn't what this is. This is an actual security breach. And the knock-on effect is that anyone with a PS3 right now is a bit pissed off.
So if you've got an account and you're worried about this, what can you do?
Well, the first thing you need to really do, I mean, there's not a lot you can do until we know what's been taken. But be very much on the lookout for any kind of phishing emails where, you know, these are the emails where people try and get you to log into their system and put in your password and things like that. Because obviously they know your name, they know your email address, so you can be targeted. So just be very careful of... well, of any emails that want you to log in that you're not expecting.
Anecdotally, I've also heard a lot of people replacing their credit cards, and when they ring up their card suppliers, the person on the other end says Sony, and they go, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of people replacing their cards too.
Yeah. Not, yeah. I don't think everyone has credit card information on file.
No.
But certainly if you are one of the people that has and you are particularly concerned, then certainly talk to your bank sooner rather than later would be the advice. On the sort of less dangerous side, Sony has said that they're hoping to get some services restored by this coming Tuesday. So you might be able to get back on...
if you're desperate to get back on and play.
Based on some of the comments we've had on the website stories on this, people are fairly angry. I don't, because I don't have a PS3. I have an Xbox represent. You know what I'm saying?
I bet an awful lot of Xbox users are all saying, well, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, I was one of them. I was one of them. But never mind. In a final quick little bit of gaming news, the Wii 2 has been announced. At least it's been announced to be coming out next year.
They've kind of announced that they're going to announce it, haven't they?
They've said they're going to be announcing it and showing it off potentially at E3, which is the big gaming trade show.
At the start of June.
That takes place in June, yeah. Mm. Which hopefully we will be at. And yeah, no details. What do we think? 3D, though? They've said, well, the...
HD, definitely.
HD is...
I'd be amazed if it wasn't HD.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think they'll probably have more stuff like voice recognition.
Well, the company's president said that it will offer a new way of playing games within the home. So look out for news in June for the Wii 2. That's enough gaming stuff. I'm bored of games now. I want to find out about a guy who has made a wooden bike. Duncan.
It's two guys, actually. It's a pair of British chaps, Michael Thompson and James Tully, who are from, I think they're from Norfolk. And they have put together a bicycle that's made entirely of wood. It doesn't have a single bit of metal, rubber or plastic in its construction.
And this includes the method by which you pedal. They've replaced chains with cogs.
Yeah,
right?
They've got this enormous, great big 128 tooth cog, one on each side, two of them, that link the pedals to the rear wheel. And yeah, it's quite the sight to behold. You should take a look at it.
Liv, you're a cyclist. You do all that pedaling stuff.
I do.
You ride a wooden bike to work?
I'm not averse to riding a wooden bike. I mean, I just think I ride a pretty ridiculous granny bike as it is. So it's not like I'm ashamed of not having the latest, sexiest bike. But I'm just be worried about it getting a bit kind of mouldy in the rain.
Mouldy?
Yeah, well, you know, getting a bit soggy, warping a little bit.
Yeah, not everyone has to worry about their own bike being a fire hazard as well.
But didn't this just come about as a result of a bet?
Yeah, that's right. Thompson and Tully were watching the Tour of Britain in their front garden, and Tully bet Thompson £1 that he couldn't make a bike entirely out of wood. And he thought, well, I can, and turned out to be right. Though I should say that this bike hasn't actually been ridden yet.
No. And they bet £1, but it's going to cost them £7,500 to break a record, correct?
Yeah, well, it's not actually breaking a record. It's just setting a record in the first place. There's no speed record for a wooden bike, but they've decided they want to set one. And to set one officially, you have to pay for the I think it's the Speed Record Club, to come down with their stopwatches and, you know, become an independent third-party adjudicator. You can't just use a stopwatch.
Yeah, that puts paid to my plan to create a cloth bike and race it around a wired office to break a record.
Well, we did have a penny farthing in the building once.
Oh,
admittedly, dear. It wasn't made of wood or cloth.
Was it in 1812?
Yeah.
No, it was in 2010, and there's photos on the site. Well, anyway, I think they're barking mad.
That was a wooden joke.
Yeah, that was... Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got some photos on the website, but all you lucky people on a computer
and
or
a video
iPod
too.
Or something. Oh, and a video, yeah. We've got a photo in the MP3's album art for this podcast, so have a peer at your iPhone or whatever you're watching or listening to this on, and you may find a photo of a wooden bike. Lucky you. Now, in the next bit of totally weird stuff news, I've heard there's a floating golf course being developed.
Wait, who'd you hear that from?
Word on the street.
Yeah. Yeah. Word on the word website is that, yeah, the Maldives are planning an 18-hole floating golf course to try and save their country from climate change.
The Maldives. And they think that £300 million being spent on a golf course that can float is going to attract better tourism in the future when their country sinks, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the Maldives has been concerned for some time about climate change, mainly because it's one of the lowest-lying countries in the entire world. It's basically a series of coral reefs. The highest point in the entire island chain is 2.3 metres above sea level, so it's pretty low.
Mm. It's almost as tall as you.
almost as tall as me. No, in fact, it's slightly taller than me. I'm about 2 meters.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, if I stood on sea level, the highest point on the island would be just slightly above my head.
So you'd probably be able to jump.
Yeah.
So we'd see a Duncan head. Anyway.
Back on topic. They are very, very worried about climate change. And what the president, a chap called Mohamed Nasheed, is trying to do is buy up land in other countries around the world, in India and in Australia and in a few other places, so that when the islands become inundated by sea level rise in a few hundred years' time, there'll be somewhere for
them to play
population
golf.
To go to.
But, and so play how, golf. How does the golf course allow them to buy land in other countries?
Well, what they're trying to do is invest large amounts in tourism at the moment. Tourism is the single largest contributor to the Maldives GDP. And so what they're doing is, by taxing the tourists and increasing the revenues that come in, they can then save the money away for a rainy day.
I'd be pretty surprised if they didn't build the golf course and the rest of the world said, oh, sorry, you can't come and stay with us because you didn't build that 18-hole floating golf course we wanted.
I don't think the relationship works quite in that way. It's more a case of, you know, they build lots and lots of interesting tourism things,
yeah.
Invest a little bit of money into it at that level. And, a few hundred million on the grand, you know, in terms of global currencies isn't actually that much money. Yeah.
But, I just don't understand why you would choose golf. I mean, have they got floating
because
balls?
Because people who play golf have got lots of money.
Yeah, but when you think about it, all a golf course
They're
really
the kind
is
of people that would go to the Maldives
is a load of holes and a small ball that's really difficult to see and fetch. So what, you hit it and you go four and then you have to swim
well,
to go and get your ball.
The different platforms, it's going to be a series of floating platforms, each with two or three holes each on, and they're going to be connected by these undersea tunnels.
All right, so it's crazy.
So it'll
golf.
Be, yeah, it'll be quite an impressive quite sight cool. to see.
Oh, I was thinking something more like the old weather map that used to be floating in the
yes.
Thames on one of the BBC or ITV news.
Tiny bit more impressive.
Yeah.
Like Good Morning, wasn't it, or something like
yeah.
that? Well, I think that's great. I still think that they should have made some kind of, a football pitch or a tennis court. You know, something that is a self-contained floating thing, but I guess that wouldn't really be as attractive.
No,
or
not for tourists.
I mean, as you mentioned earlier, Nate, the very fact that a whole load of islands are sinking could be a tourist attraction.
Well, that's what I said.
Itself.
I mean, look at Atlantis. Well, I mean, you can't because it doesn't exist. But everyone makes such a fuss about it because it sank.
Yeah.
I mean, here is a, one that's actually in existence. Why not use water polo? I mean, take advantage of what you've been given.
Because horses aren't very good at swimming.
Well, that's true. okay, well, that's. I think they're building that, hopefully, by 2015. So, great. Go and play golf in the Maldives.
Yeah, it'll be about... I think it's planned to be about 5 minutes from the Maldives International Airport, Malé. Mm.
We're going to have a short break, and afterwards, we're going to learn about a keyboard made of bacon fat that lets birds tweet.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the interactive May issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
Tweeting birds with bacon fat. Liv, this smells like a Olivia _ Solon story, right?
Are you saying that I smell constantly of bacon?
No, I say you write about weird stuff for us.
Yeah, well, this is a Latvian magazine is actually responsible for this little project. A particular guy called Voldemars Dudum. Again, I'm really sorry if I pronounced that wrong. My Latvian isn't quite up to scratch. But he wanted to create a system that would allow real birds to tweet. And so what he did was he rigged up a keyboard and placed little chunks of bacon fat on every single keyboard. He nailed them in. And then that obviously attracted the birds, which came down to peck away at the bacon. And as they pecked on the little keys, they typed out little tweets. And that was instantly delivered to a Twitter account, which was at @hungry_birds. Another underscore.
Underscore and proud.
Yes, underscore and proud.
So what, the birds come down, they're like, what up, ribs, and stop
yeah.
pecking away at the keyboards.
Yeah.
And bacon fat.
And they had they had a webcam linked up to this. Unfortunately, it's just finished. The webcam is no longer live because it's now spring and the little birds no longer need the bacon fat to keep them warm through the winter. They now have little grubs and insects to go and munch on.
So is this just an enormous, terrible pun?
No, it's a really pretty cool promotional stunt for who I hope is not a competitor. Do we have a magazine?
Latvian weekly magazine called Ear. Unfortunately, I don't know whether it's a competitor or not.
Credit where credit's due.
It's a weekly news magazine, so I think it's,
It's pretty cool. Do you want to hear one of the tweets that the birds left?
Yes.
I've got them in front of me.
Definitely.
I'm going to pick the most possible to pronounce, but I have to say, don't expect to be, learning anything here. So here's a tweet from 15 days ago. Oh, wow, they set this up a while ago. 21211212212211212221111 and so forth. It's not
almost binary, isn't it?
It's not riveting. But do you think if you put enough birds on enough bacon fat keyboards, they would eventually type Shakespeare?
I guess they would, yeah, yeah.
They'd start with Hamlet.
Or omelette. That's not really.
Yeah, we've got plenty of these puns I think we went through when we published this, but it's probably best not to rehash them all.
Kingfisher Lear.
Yep.
Yeah.
That would work.
Dove's Labour's Lost.
Much Ado About Puffin.
Ornithello.
More of
this. Oh, we're doing it. We're doing it.
Let's stop right now.
More thrilling puns on wired.co.uk. Okay, before we get into talking about bouncing bombs, something pretty weird happened on Amazon where a book about flies ended up costing $24 million by mistake.
Yes.
How did this happen?
Well, it's quite a common practice for retailers on Amazon to set their prices against a particular competitor. So you might want to always undercut your competitor by a little bit, or in some cases you might even want to charge a bit more. Perhaps you don't have the same distribution network or the same resources, so you might want to charge a bit more.
So you can say monitor for this person and always charge, say, 10% less.
Exactly. So this case dealt with a little known book called The Making of a Fly by Peter Lawrence, which went out of publication in 1992. But the two book retailers had set their prices against each other. So one had set it to always be just slightly undercutting their competitor by a tiny percentage. And the other changed their pricing algorithm to charge slightly more. I think it's a 20% more than its competitor because they didn't have all the books in stock. So they'd have to actively go and seek them if someone bought it. So what happened was, and when one of them changed their price, the other one leapt up to just below it. And then when it was just below that price, the other retailer's price shot up by 20%. And this kind of continued in a kind of
feedback loop,
exactly, until the price reached $23 million, £698,655.93.
But no one actually noticed until someone went to buy this book for university, didn't they? And he went back every day to notice it had gone up by like $1 million since the previous day or something.
Exactly. A professor, a student under Michael Eisen at the UC Berkeley University, noticed it and flagged it up. And they kept on going back to check it. And the price was going up almost exponentially, and then they did some minor calculations and worked out that they must have set their prices like this, and it wasn't noticed for a couple of weeks, and then now, and I love the fact that it was 23 million. Well, I won't say the whole number again. Plus $3.99 shipping.
I think that if you're paying $23 million for a book, I think shipping should be free.
Yeah,
delivered to your door, quite personally.
But one of them's obviously noticed the mistake, and the book is now on sale for the bargain price of $106.
Still a lot for a book about flies.
Yeah, but these academic texts.
Famous flies? Okay, well, we're going to move on to our feature this week, which concerns bouncing bombs. Now, Duncan, you wrote a really interesting story yesterday about a team of documentary filmmakers and researchers and scientists who've been making a new version of the bouncing bomb from World War II. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, they've been following the efforts of a Cambridge University engineer called Hugh Hunt, who's been trying to recreate the work of a chap in the Second World War called Barnes Wallace, who designed these bombs that were that would sort of skip along the surface of the water to attack dams on Germany's rivers.
That was to avoid nets, wasn't it? Because they had nets in the sea.
Yeah, in front of all these dams, they have torpedo nets because they're quite wise to the prospect that you know, there's going to be bombs targeted at these dams because they're quite important to the wartime infrastructure. And they were sort of brainstorming ideas to try and get past these nets. And they came up with the idea, a bit like skimming stones over the surface of the water, skimming bombs.
Mm. Okay, well, so these are being recreated for a documentary that's coming up. And we're going to speak to Professor Hugh Hunt, who I think is the one of the engineers behind this project at University of Cambridge. And let's give him a call.
Hugh Hunt speaking.
Hi, it's Duncan from Wired.
Hi, Duncan.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem.
So first of all, do you reckon you could tell us a little bit about the history of the bouncing bomb?
So what Barnes Wallace was thinking was that in order to win the war, we needed to disable the infrastructure of the German war machinery. And key to that infrastructure was the production of electricity and steel and so on and so forth. And he deduced that water was a key resource for the production of steel. And then deduced that, well, power stations were well protected, but the dams were vulnerable. And he came up with this scheme of blowing up the dams in some way. He realized he needed a single very powerful bomb rather than lots of little ones. You could drop 5 tons of 250-pound bombs, but that would just sort of pepper the surface of a dam. Whereas if you dropped 1 5-ton bomb that had the possibility of blowing up the dam, then to deliver that bomb, he thought of dropping it from a high altitude so the bomber wouldn't be vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. But then there wasn't sufficient accuracy available at that time to get a bomb to land on, you know, right up against the dam. So he then went to another strategy, which was to bounce the bomb over torpedo nets, which were placed in front of the dams, because the Germans realized that the dams were vulnerable, so they put torpedo nets in to prevent torpedoes being used against the dams. And then the rest really is history. I mean, that's, he then worked out that he could, in fact, bounce these bombs. He did some tests on small ones to start with, and then realized that he could get a 5-ton bomb to bounce. And that was used successfully in May 1943.
Why did you choose to recreate his research?
Well, it's one of these things. I suppose it's intellectual curiosity in one part, and also this guy Barnes Wallis was incredibly creative and ingenious, and none of that really comes across in. There's a 1954 movie with Michael Redgrave in it, and the actual technology doesn't come across really there, and the details of how to get this thing to bounce, well, a lot of it was, they were military secrets still then, so it's really nice to be able to open this up for more scrutiny, so people can see, for instance, how important spin is on these bombs. The 1954 movie, they weren't allowed to talk about spin at all. It was still a military secret. So it's just one of these things that 60 years has passed. It's never been done again since then. Actually doing it, you really see firsthand just how incredible an exercise it was, and it makes you appreciate all the more just what an amazing guy Barnes Wallis was and what an amazing team he had to work with.
What are some of the, without going into too much detail, what are some of the technical challenges that you faced when you were trying to replicate his work, and how did you overcome that?
Well, the real thing which you have to admire Barnes Wallis for is that you start off by doing scale model tests with, you know, with marbles or cricket balls or whatever. And then you start thinking, how do we scale this up? Well, we scaled it up to, you know, only half the size that Barnes Wallis used. But the difficulties we had were, how do you mount a big, heavy spinning object underneath the plane and make sure that it releases properly? It's quite a job to release to have something spinning fast and then release it cleanly. And so that was one difficulty we had. Another difficulty we had was trying to get the pilots to fly consistently at the right altitude and in the right line. Now, we had difficulty with that in daytime. Imagine how difficult it was for the World War II pilots to do that at nighttime and not to be able to practice against the targets that they were aiming for. And then we had difficulty. We decided not to put a motor into the plane to spin the bombs up. Barnes Wallis had a motor in because his targets were 3 hours flying away. We decided that since our target was only 10 minutes away, we could spin the bomb up on the runway, and it would still be spinning fast enough when it got to the dam. But it turned out that the fast-moving air moving over the bomb caused it to slow down very rapidly. So we had to think of a way of getting the bomb to keep spinning, and we managed to figure that one out while we were there. So there were, I suppose, they were the three big challenges. Oh, even trying to decide how we were going to build our bombs. We didn't have any. There were no detailed records surviving from Barnes Wallace's original exercise, so we had to start from scratch, really. And our design was rather different from Barnes Wallace's design, but we had to make sure that it wasn't going to break up on impact with the water. We had to make sure that it was balanced, so that when it was spinning, just like you get your car tyres balanced, we had to balance these bombs. That was quite a big problem.
And are there modern applications for this sort of this research still? Are these kinds of bombs still used today?
No, they're not. I mean, nowadays, with targeting accuracy, you know, guided missiles, there's no need for this kind of technology. And it was researched in the early years after the war because there were thoughts that a bouncing bomb would be useful for targeting ships at sea. The idea was that ships at sea had a soft underbelly, in that they were very heavily armoured on the sides to deal with torpedoes, but the underneath of a ship was vulnerable. So if you could bounce a bomb, it would hit the side of the ship, it would then sink down alongside the ship and then explode when it just got to the underside of the ship. But there were, as you'll see in the film on Monday, there were a few tests done in shortly after the war, where it was established that on rough water, it was very likely that the bomb would come up and hit the aircraft, and that did happen on one occasion, which was a bit of a disaster. So that strategy was abandoned. So it was really only on one occasion, which was in May 1943, that this method was used successfully, but it hasn't been used since.
Okay, great. And the documentary that has been following your efforts to recreate it is showing next week, is that right?
It shows on Monday night, Channel 4 at 8 o'clock. And it's a two-hour documentary, so settle down with a glass or a mug of your favourite beverage and, enjoy it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Hunt. And on that note, we're going to wrap up the show. Duncan, tell everyone how they can contact us.
You can and should contact us by tweeting us at WiredUK on Twitter. Nate is at Nate Langson. I am at Duncan Gear, and Liv is at Olivia_Solon. And you can email us too, podcast@wired.co.uk. And I believe we've had an email this week, haven't we?
Yeah, this came in from Edward Bennigsen, who was listening to last week's podcast, to tell us that he finished Portal 2 over the weekend and is loving it, because we were talking last week about how I didn't bother
playing, amazing it is,
how I didn't bother playing Portal and played Dragon Age instead or something. And he's written in to say that he loves it. And he says, also, tell Duncan he has a better taste in games than Nate.
It is quite
regards,
true.
Edward. Thanks for
thank you, Edward. You're quite right.
Email us on podcast@wired.co.uk, of course, if you want to send some reasons why I am right. And on that note, we will see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Horses really struggle to pick up cups.
With the hooves.
They just break
nose cups.
They just break the cups on grip.